Guys, so I had the pleasure of interviewing my next guest for the Anxiety Support Summit, and he just blew me and our listeners away with all his wisdom. Tim Desmond is a psychotherapist, author, distinguished faculty scholar at Antioch University at New England, and student of Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. He is the author of three brilliant books, Self-Compassion and Psychotherapy, The Self-Compassion Skills Workbook, and How to Stay Human in a Fucked Up World. Tim is well known for his teaching of mindfulness and self-compassion practices to audiences around the world. He is also founder of an incredible new company, Peer Collective, offering the most affordable counseling services I've ever heard of, making mental health support more accessible than ever, which I think is amazing. So for anyone struggling with mental health, research shows that self-compassion is not only a skill we can strengthen through practice, but also one of the strongest predictors of mental health and wellness. And Tim is a master of it all. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Tim, welcome to the No Bullshit Anxiety Talk Show.
It's really good to talk to you again, Nick.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure to have you back. We had so many messages and comments from your last talk, just saying how much it benefited people. So I'm really excited to dive into some of the topics again. So just before we get into all of that, tell us a little bit about Peer Collective, because it is just an incredible initiative.
Yeah, so there's a the way that I think about therapy and counseling and mindfulness, they kind of all come together for me. The way that Thich Nhat Hanh would talk about how we overcome suffering, right? What he would say is that compassionate presence, like compassionate awareness, is the key ingredient to transform suffering. And we can look at that from a neuroscience perspective. We can kind of understand that for any mammal, feeling kind of cared for is one of the core regulating mechanisms to reduce fear and anxiety and stress. So when we understand that care, that compassion, and that sort of like presence are what's really important for transforming suffering, well, where does that compassionate presence come from? It can come from yourself. If you train yourself in mindfulness and self-compassion, then we can learn how to bring a compassionate presence to our own suffering. But for a lot of people, that's really hard. I mean, even while we're learning how to try to do that, often our suffering feels like it's too big to really be able to hold with compassion. And so that's why we need other people. It's the same practice of being held by somebody else's compassionate presence. That, and it has that sort of same transforming effect, right? So decades of research in clinical psychology have shown, you know what the biggest predictor is of mental health outcomes, like or counseling outcomes? It's the relationship. It's the personal qualities of the provider. The qualities like warmth, empathy, and what's often called alliance in the literature. But what they're just, when they talk about warmth and empathy and alliance, they're just using different words for what Thich Nhat Hanh would call compassion. Right? It's what it is, it's your ability to be face to face with suffering, with someone who's suffering, and stay open and present and caring. Right? And if that's the biggest predictor of what makes counseling effective, well, that's great news, because you don't have to pay $150 an hour to find someone who's exceptional at being present. And one of the things that that I view as kind of revolutionary about Peer Collective, we have a whole system that we've developed with our clinical advisory team, where basically what we do is we identify regular people who have exceptional empathy, exceptional compassion, an exceptional ability to sort of build an alliance with you. Mm-hmm. And then we provide them with the resources that they need to become peer counselors. And so we're able to offer, like, if you're suffering and you want to talk to somebody, we can offer like someone's undivided attention for $14 for a 30-minute session or $28 for a 60-minute session. And we can offer that because we understand how to find people who are exceptional at compassion. But this idea of like whether that compassionate presence comes from me or whether it comes from somebody else, it's the same alchemy in terms of the compassionate presence when it's brought in touch with suffering creates transformation.
Mm. Yeah, that's incredible. I've been diving deeper and deeper into self-compassion and the whole world that it embodies, and reading yeah. more books on Buddhism on the back of our chat, and just kind of like mm-hmm. learning more about mindfulness and not necessarily what we perceive mindfulness to be in the West. I remember it was more of a neuroscience book, The Inflamed Mind, where I came across this as actually scientific literature for the first time, where it said, you know, the biggest predictor of helping someone through a transformation is not actually it's got nothing to do with PhDs or anything like that. It's the relationship they have and the ability to trust and feel safe in the person that they're sitting opposite, whether it be on a screen in times of corona or face to face. Which is like, it's incredible as well. I see it myself, you know. It's just like most people, I guess, who are really suffering in this world, a lot of the time, you know, they haven't felt safe, and they've grown up in an environment where they've never felt safe, so they don't trust people. And when they learn that someone has empathy towards them, is trustworthy, wants to listen, cheers for them with their victories and stuff, that can just completely transform their world. And it's a pretty cool thing to see. And it's amazing that you're able to deliver it at scale at such affordable prices. So,
So the neuroscientist Jaak Panset, he was like one of the first kind of neuroscientists to study emotion. One of the things that he was really interested in is trying to understand what are the fundamental, what he called emotional kind of structures in a mammal's brain. Like, what are the anatomical features that all mammals share that give rise to what he would call primary emotions? And he discovered 7. There are 2 that he calls positive, 3 that he calls negative, and 2 that he calls neutral. So the 2 that he calls positive are the care circuit and the play circuit. And these are kind of relatively well-defined structures in every mammal's brain. When your care circuit is active, it releases oxytocin, it releases natural opiates, and it's basically what gets turned on when you're experiencing kind of care and love. Your play circuit is the other kind of core, like a primary positive emotion that all mammals share. And it's what gets turned on when you're having fun. The 3 that he calls negative, if we don't like the term negative, then we can call them, they're part of our threat response system. There are 3 different, so Panset says there are 3 different ways of dealing with a threat. So there is the fear center, the grief center, grief or panic, and then the rage center. But there are 3 different ways of dealing with a threat. So according to Panset, if your mind perceives a threat, then it tries to figure out, well, one, can I avoid this threat? And if your brain believes that the best way to handle this threat is to avoid it, it'll activate the fear center in your brain and you will freeze or flee. And that's all about avoiding a threat, fear. If your brain believes that the best chance for whatever, throughout whatever its conditioning, that your best chance of responding to this threat is to either overpower it or scare it away, then it'll activate your rage circuit, which is another way of responding to a threat. Try to scare it away, try to overpower it.
Mm.
And if it believes that the best way of responding to this threat is to solicit help from other members of your species, then it'll activate the grief circuit and you'll cry or whimper. And that's sort of a signal to other members of your species that you need help. It's just another way of responding to a threat. The two neutral circuits are a little bit, you can read Punsip's work if you're interested in those. Those are the lust circuit and the kind of, you know, motivation or interest circuit. But yeah, the ones that I'm really interested in.
Neutral.
He calls it because it can be paired with positive or negative. But the idea, the ones that I think are like more in scope for us to talk about, if you want to, like, Ponsip's work is fascinating and you can read more about it. But the ones that I want to talk about here is one thing that Ponsip has shown, both in like living animals as well as in laboratory settings, is if you take any mammal that is distressed, its fear circuit, rage circuit, or grief circuit are active. If you can turn on either the care circuit or play circuit in their brain, and he would say that you can turn this on naturally, or you can turn it on using microelectrodes in animal experiments, just turn it on with electricity, the distress that animal is experiencing will decrease dramatically. And he calls it basically, care and play are our two most fundamental ways of regulating distress, which makes sense as a human, right? When we're in distress, what helps? Well, one is getting empathy, and the other is having, like, you know, perspective, or, you know, finding some humor in way, like, you know, I've worked in a lot of like intense mental health settings, and there's always kind of a lot of kind of dark humor that emerges as a way of coping. You know, we crack jokes as a way to regulate when things are feeling heavy. So but in terms of the care circuit in our brain, it's something that we can activate ourselves through the practice of self-compassion, or it's something that can be turned on in us in the experience of counseling. If you're present with somebody that you feel cares about you, that where that relationship is there, like, that's kind of, for me, ultimately what it comes down to.
Yeah, wow, that's so good. And so what's the kind of process like? So most people in despair are struggling, and they're in suffering with the three negative ones. Like, is the antidote simply just a focus on care and laughter and humor to pull them out of that, to transform them into a beautiful state?
I mean, I think it's complicated and different for different people. I think that that's one important solution. I think that human beings are more complicated than other mammals. And I think part of that is, so there's a question of how do we want to respond when we perceive a threat, right? How can we recognize that there's a threat and that we're in distress, and then kind of feel that care or that play ability to kind of get through it? Mm-hmm. But then there are other things that are like, a lot of times we're perceiving a threat where there isn't one. And that's sort of a learned response often, that, so let's say if my father was really abusive, then every time I meet an older man, I start to perceive a threat. Whereas like this, you know, this is sort of like a, you know, operant conditioning where like now I have this association, this kind of learned association of older man equals threat, where in that it can be really helpful to learn how like not to make that generalization. So it's more complicated, but ultimately any of those shifts that in Buddhism we would call insight, like the insight that helps us to see through a sort of a fear that's based in delusion, that insight can only come about once we've kind of regulated our emotions to some degree, right? If I'm fully in panic mode, I'm not going to find an insight. I'm not going to see clearly. So the first step is always compassion, is always this kind of care. And then once I've settled a little bit, then there's the possibility of having insight and kind of seeing through my situation more clearly.
We're at that heightened emotional state, it's impossible to kind of gain perspective and just kind of calm yourself down. You almost need to, I think, just let it pass and then just kind of step away from it and then do your journaling, take a walk, let it process, have a conversation, hopefully with someone who's going to have empathy for your situation. With regards to the caring, is there an argument, like, because obviously, you know, if you, you know, like I think you said before, right, obviously the people that are highly empathetic and are going to get on the phone and spend all this time with these people, they obviously get something out of it as well. So it's igniting the care gene. I forget the word you used to describe the seven of them.
It's true. And actually, a few years ago, I did a meta-analysis of, or sort of like a literature review of all of the non-pharmaceutical treatments for depression and wrote a paper about it. And the non-pharmaceutical treatment for depression that had the largest effect size was volunteering. And so there were a lot of things, you know, a lot of nutritional things and exercise lifestyle things and, you know, that counseling and, you know, all the things that we know that are good for you. But volunteering actually had the largest effect size. Now, anyone who's been depressed knows that getting the energy together to do something like that is not easy when you're depressed. But if you're able to do it, that ability, that feeling of being able to give, it's a really powerful mood regulator.
I wrote an article on tips to manage depression that don't cost a thing the other day, and I had 8 of them, so I definitely got to update it to 9 and include volunteering. It just didn't come to my mind, but that's incredible that you were able to hypothesize that and prove that to be the case. Because it's weird, because so many people, a lot of people that work in care tend to have emotional distress themselves. And I guess, like, if you're actually going in as a volunteer, there's a difference. Like, you don't have to be there. You're doing it for the good of humanity. So there's that, like, separation from it's your duty, as it's your job, whereas you're actually going, like, no, there's, like, people need help in this world, I'm going to give some of my time away for free. Not to take anything away from people that do it for money, like, it's incredible.
Sure. You know, well, I think that, and actually that's one thing that that's one thing that we're actually thinking about for at Peer Collective. I think that the beauty of volunteering is that you're giving and contributing in a way that's like out, that that feels like a gift as opposed to feels like an obligation. And I think one of the reasons, so one thing that we that we're doing at Peer Collective is that right now our peer counselors are limited to only working 10 hours a week as a sort of a maximum. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that if we're selecting for people who have kind of exceptional warmth and emotional intelligence, I don't think that there's anybody who can do, you know, 30 or 40 hours of direct service for very long and maintain that kind of full presence. This idea, and so for us, it's like if it's something that you only do some of,
yeah,
then and that it's sort of balanced in your life, then it can have that kind of feeling of you're really offering a gift.
Yeah, that's a brilliant approach, because it certainly can weigh you down, especially if you're trying to condense 40 hours of conversations like that. I don't think many people on the planet could even do it for a week and stay present and deliver as good a service as they need to. So what, I'm fascinated to know how many years did you spend with Thich Nhat Hanh? And maybe you could just give a little bit of an introduction to Thich Nhat Hanh, because ever since we spoke, he's popping up all over the place in literature I read.
Yeah. So when I was in college, so I got into college actually on a sports scholarship. I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And I was somewhat, you know, we had grown up really poor in Boston. I had a single mom who was an alcoholic, and you know, I had a lot of anxiety and anger and you know, just difficulties by the time I got into college. And in a political science class, I was assigned to read a book by Thich Nhat Hanh called Peace is Every Step. And it talks, so Thich Nhat Hanh was, he ordained as a Buddhist monk in Vietnam when he was 16 years old, which is actually kind of old for at that time in Vietnam. He was a young person during the French-Vietnamese War and then grew into adulthood during the American-Vietnamese War. And he was famous in Vietnam for organizing sort of nonviolent resistance that was not allied with North or South Vietnamese governments, but just sort of like a movement for peace. Mm-hmm. He then was, because of that, he was exiled from Vietnam and became a refugee in France, where he started taking students and writing books about his practice. And the center that he started in France is called Plum Village, and it's still there. And so, but he's a Vietnamese Buddhist teacher and peace activist who has been a really core teacher for me, since I was 19 years old. I read Peace is Every Step, and what I found in it was exactly what was missing in my life. Those teachings of mindfulness and compassion felt like completely missing and exactly what I needed. And so then I basically spent the next 10 years, I would go back and forth. I would work for a little while, and then I would spend time in the monastery with Thich Nhat Hanh or following him on a tour. Then I would go and get involved in some sort of like social justice kind of movement for a little while. And then I'd come back to the monastery and, you know, follow him around again. And I spent about 10 years like that, just really trying to do everything that I can to understand the practices that it just like felt like what I needed. And then eventually I decided that I needed to get some kind of a job and wanted my job to be about sharing my practice. And that's how I got into mental health.
Mm. Wow. I'm just curious to know, what's a typical day like in the monastery, like when you're shadowing?
Yeah. So, there's a schedule that's pretty loose. So you'll wake up at, 5 a.m. or so, and there'll be silent sitting meditation in the large meditation hall, and then chanting. Then there'll be some space, some breakfast. Then often there'll be a Dharma talk in the morning, okay, followed by outdoor walking meditation. Then there'll be lunch. And then there'll either be some type of small group discussion about the Dharma talk, or some kind of like working meditation. Then dinner, then silent sitting, and sleep. So it's a very open kind of schedule. But every time there's a bell at Plum Village, which is often, because there are bells to begin every activity and to end every activity, and sort of 15 minutes before they start, and all the clocks are set to chime every 15 minutes. So every time there's a bell, everyone stops what they're doing and takes 3 breaths. And it's not the stopping that's like you're freezing, like you're playing freeze tag, but instead it's this invitation to stop what you're doing and ask yourself, where am I? What am I doing? What do I need to feel? Like, what is missing? What do I need in order to feel truly peaceful and content in this moment?
Mm.
And often the only thing that's needed is that question. You recognize that actually there's nothing missing.
Yeah, wow.
And just being able to there's this constant practice of being engaged and then stopping, and being engaged and then stopping.
And I guess it's in the West, in our world, is we don't do the stopping.
Yeah.
It's just go, go, go. So yeah, that sounds pretty incredible. I can imagine just from that bell, just go.
Yeah.
Check in with yourself.
Yeah.
Stop a lot of crap from building up in the process.
Yeah.
Wow. And what we like, so, Dharma is basically teaching in Buddhism. And what were some of, like, what were the talks? Was it Thich Nhat Hanh giving the talks?
For a long time, it was just Thich Nhat Hanh giving the talks. And as he got older, he started encouraging more of the other monks and nuns to give talks. And then a few years ago, he had a stroke and he doesn't speak anymore. And so now it's always kind of these other like monastics who are trained by him that are giving the talks. And the talks, they can range in anything, but many of the talks are about the practice of, well, I would say all of the talks are about the practice of cultivating joy and overcoming or transforming suffering. And they're just all of the different Buddhist practices or the speaker's own experience with learning how to embrace and transform suffering and learning how to pay attention to what's beautiful in life and cultivate joy.
Wow. And this might be a ridiculously impossible question to answer. And if it is, that's okay. Because there's so much learning that goes on in Buddhism. But what would you say some of the main lessons that come to your mind that you carry with you on a day-to-day basis as religion, I guess, Buddhism, philosophy, religion, whatever?
Yeah. Well, I think for me, it's like it's just self-understanding. Like one thing that I've learned really deeply from Thich Nhat Hanh. So one is that there are two sides of. Well, I guess the first thing that I would say is that it is possible to practice and cultivate your mind in such a way that can make life beautiful and worth living. And I think that's like the biggest thing that I've gotten from him. And that's what like the first book that I read by Thich Nhat Hanh, I had this like almost like a flavor of like, oh, that's what life should be like, is like this ability to see what's beautiful in life and to be able to face what's painful filled with love and openness. And that ultimately what I get from Buddhism is that those capacities, like the capacity to like look at life and see beauty and the capacity to look at pain with openness and love, those are things that we can grow in ourselves. And really, it's like more than, at least for me, it's like more important than anything else that I could imagine.
Yeah. Wow. And so for our listeners, what are, first, I also have to ask, do you ever get pissed off?
You can ask my son. I mean, I'd say I get, is he coming? I think he might have heard me. So I have a 7-year-old son. I honestly was pissed off at the Boston Celtics last night for blowing a playoff game.
Oh,
I suffer, and when, okay, cool. I suffer, and when I'm suffering, I often forget my practice, and then eventually, at some point, I remember it again.
Yeah, so it's that self-awareness is so vitally important.
Yeah.
Wow. So I'm sorry. I hope the Celtics can get back, and they're still in with a shot.
Yeah.
At least there is basketball season going on. I suppose that's one of the wins at the moment. So for someone listening, what are some things they can do to cultivate less suffering in their life?
I think the first thing that I would recommend, at least like right in this moment, so many of us spend so much time trying to figure out how we can transform, deal with our suffering, that we forget that there's more to life than our suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's one thing that I would recommend for people is to don't forget, don't ignore the conditions that are beautiful in life. And because experiences of beauty and experiences of joy, that's like the fuel that we need in order to be present with our suffering, in order to deal with our suffering. And if we never kind of refill our fuel tank of beauty and joy, we're going to be too exhausted to do anything about our suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. That's amazing. And what would you say some of the, like, if someone were to pick up your book today, the How to Stay Human in a Fucked Up World, which is a title I just love, what do you hope are some of the biggest takeaways they would get from that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly talk about my suffering in that book. I think the main thing that I'd want someone to get from that book is confidence and trust that it's possible to care about the world without being harmed by it. Like, it's possible to actually, we don't need to shut ourselves off from pain, that it's possible to develop an ability to be open-hearted, even as fucked up as the world is and as painful as our lives can be, that we can develop an openness and an ability to be present for ourselves and others, and to be able to give.
Amazing, amazing. And anyone can grab that on Amazon or any bookstore. Well, after. Is it in the bookstores?
Yeah. You can find it anywhere. Yeah.
And we'll link to it below. So just before, firstly, I'd like to thank you again. I'm just blown away by all your wisdom and love chatting with you and love kind of learning about this stuff. So if someone listening is, you know, is in need of support and they want to go out and chat with someone in Peer Collective and kind of just see what a kind of transformation they can find within themselves, where can they go?
So we can put a link at this on the podcast for everybody. So for a limited time, everybody, for right now and for everybody who's listening to this podcast, but for a limited time, everybody who tries Peer Collective gets to have one free session just to kind of try it out and see what it's like. And then subsequent sessions, as I mentioned, it's 14 for a half hour or 28 for a full hour. Let's put a link on the podcast.
Okay.
And everybody who listens to the podcast can head over and just try a free session and see what it's like. Our research shows that about 75% of the people who try Peer Collective love their first counselor. And if you talk to three different counselors, more than 98% of people find a counselor that they feel like is just a perfect fit for them. So that's why we kind of encourage people to try, about three quarters of people love the first person they talk to, but if you try a couple of people, you're almost guaranteed to find somebody that you feel like is a great match.
Wow, that's incredible statistics. I don't know that's some of the bigger companies that are doing this on mass scale are pulling in numbers like this. So you absolutely credit to you. You must be doing an absolutely exceptional job recruiting these people, and it cannot be easy. And to actually to deliver this service at such affordable rates that can actually, like, not just transform a life, but save a life, let's be honest, is amazing. So hats off to you. That's incredible. And if you're listening and you are struggling, then you've absolutely nothing to lose. You know, that you've nothing to lose and a whole world and life to gain from trying this out. So do give it a go. And I know from speaking to so many that getting on that first call with anyone to talk about something, your vulnerabilities and your struggles in life is not an easy thing. And I've no doubt that these people are going to be able to take care of you and make it just feel like something that was simple and you should have done ages ago. Tim, thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with me. Is there anything else you want to add before I let you go?
Thank you so much. It's great to connect.